And our final speaker is William Whitney from APU, talking about human flourishing from perspectives of positive psychology and theology.
Hi, everyone. My name is William Whitney. I teach in the Department of Psychology at Azusa Pacific University. Excuse me, I still get choked up teaching there. I'm a weird mix. I did my PhD in theology. I worked in the church some. I went back and got a degree as a therapist, and then I got hired as a professor. And I'm currently finishing up my PhD in developmental psychology at Claremont Graduate. So this is really an interdisciplinary dialogue, and my hope is to expose you to some of the research, both from positive psych and Christian theology, and have some dialogue about human flourishing. So this is where we'll be going today. I will start off by giving an overview of positive psych. I will talk about a few difficulties with positive psychology, a few promises of positive psychology. Then we will move in the latter two points of the presentation towards understanding the Christian theology of flourishing and understanding some Christian virtues that can contribute to positive psychology. So, positive psychology, an overview. How many of you, just show of hands, have heard the term positive psychology? Anybody? Okay, good, about half of you. No worries if you haven't, but I don't want to belabor the point if people are familiar with it. This movement basically started, it's talked about as a movement having a long history and a short past. Basically, Martin Seligman became the APA president in 1998. He had a focus of his work that he wanted to steer the American Psychological Association towards. And basically, this idea was that in the past, psychology is mainly focused on what has gone wrong with humans, pathology, instead of actually looking at what goes right with humans, okay? And Mike Csikszentmihalyi, along with Martin Seligman, really started off pioneering this movement. Along the way came Christopher Peterson that joined Seligman. We'll talk about him in just a second. But the basic idea is that we focus a lot on pathology, but human goodness, excellence, these are as authentic and as real things to study as pathology, as disease, order, and distress. So the focus became looking at character strengths, virtues, and so forth. So positive psych really begins by asking different questions. Instead of asking what's wrong with a human person, positive psych begins by asking questions like, what do people need to thrive? And in that way, by starting with that point, positive psychology really begins to start asking questions about virtues, values, and traits that people need to thrive. And this, of course, from a theological point of view, this is where I get interested, because it's like, oh, wow, Christian theology has some things to say about that. Now, there are some difficulties with positive psych. I'll give you one critique from within the field of psychology and one critique from folks that would say that they're philosophers or theologians. The first one is, how do we really characterize what is optimal, okay? I'll give you a great example of this. Jean Tsai, she's a psychologist at Stanford, has a 2007 study. It's a really interesting study where she looked at Euro-American mothers and East Asian mothers. And both of the mothers were asked, what is the ideal affect that you want? What is the ideal emotional state? What is the optimal development and affect that you want from your children? You might guess, Euro-American mom said, I want my kid to smile at me. I want them to be energetic. When they studied the intonations, happy, look at me, baby. Daddy's home, mommy's home, right? When they asked the East Asian mothers said, calmness. I want my baby to be soothed. I want my baby to be socially adjusted. And when they looked at the intonation of mothers, how they interacted with the East Asian infants, calming tones were used. The prolonged lower tones were used to soothe the baby, to make the baby calm. So that gives you an example when we're talking about ideal affect. How do we really talk about that, about what is optimal? So that's a critique mainly from cultural psychology for positive psychology. One of the other critiques is leveled by theologians and philosophers about the character strength kind of taxonomy that Seligman and Peterson came up with. So when the movement started, what they basically did, these guys, is they looked at major world religions, Confucianism, Sikhism, Buddhism, Islam, Christianity, Islam. Did I say Judaism? Judaism. They looked at luminaries like Aristotle, even Thomas Aquinas. And what they did is they come up with a list of universal values. It's in their 2004 book, Character, Strengths, and Values, by that name. And they basically said, these are the values and strengths that we want to promote in human behavior, and we also want to study. The difficulty is that by doing that, it stripped away some of the theological and philosophical content that actually made some of those virtues what they are. So what do you mean, William? What are you talking about? Well, I'm glad you asked. Let's look at hope, for instance. So in Seligman and Peterson, they define hope as a positive mental state where one believes that good events will outweigh the bad. Notice where the agency is. Agency is in the person, grounded in one's own abilities. When we look at this from Christian theology, first of all, I'm going to compare Christian theology with Seligman. Please note, I know it's hard to summarize one definition, but I pulled together a couple from Aquinas and then Moltmann, who's a contemporary theologian. But basically, hope is understood in Christian theology as a future established by God. God provides then the strength in the present to persist, and it's grounded first and foremost in God's action, right? So you can see we have some difficulties, even though the same word is used in both contexts. So that would be an example of how some of this philosophical and theological content is kind of deconstructed. So that's one of the issues we come with when we come to understanding flourishing from positive psych and Christian theology perspectives, is we have to kind of think about or overcome this barrier. Some of the promises of positive psychology. Well, first of all, positive psychology, I believe I'm an advocate of it, and I believe that it really creates this space to talk about what are the things that humans should value? What are the things that are important? What are the things that make life meaningful? You know, those are all really important questions to ask. And by asking them, also, positive psych is not excluding Christian responses, you know? In fact, there's many journals out there, Journal of Positive Psych, that have articles about Christians' understanding of well-being or flourishing, right? And so you actually have now more movement in this field to talk about some of the distinctives of Christian religion and other religions as well. So we have this space now, and it's important to realize that I believe as Christians who work in the field of psychology, that we have an opportunity to talk about some of these distinctive virtues from a Christian perspective. So towards a Christian theology of flourishing, well, small disclaimer here. I think that there are two key doctrines that I'm going to look at. There's a lot, y'all. So we can't just limit it to one or two. I'm only going to talk about one or two because I only have 13 minutes left. But anyway, there's a lot, right? In the book that I just recently put out with my colleague, we talk about incarnation, we talk about spirit, of course, we talk about Christology, we talk about Imago Dei, but the two that form the framework that I believe are really important are creation and the doctrine of the Trinity. So the first one is creation. So when we think about a Christian theology of thriving, I will argue that the doctrine of creation is vitally, vitally important. Now, first of all, when we say the doctrine of creation, we are not simply talking about God's movement to create a world in the beginning. The systematic formulation of creation is the idea of God's beginning point of creation, but God's continuing to sustain and be with creation and his creatures throughout the course of history into the consummation of the ages and even into the next age. Okay? But creation provides a stage where God's goodness can exist. All right? We can think of it as a host setting a table where this provides a space for us to experience and welcome other things. So humans are created then with a cognitive, emotional, relational, spiritual capacities to experience grace and beauty in my understanding of creation. Not only that, creation provides the space for a life to be flourishing or to experience well-being, but God always also provides the mechanism for doing that in his Trinitarian relations with the world. So God, through the Son and Spirit, he redeems the world. That's, we talk about that a lot in evangelical thought. But as Christians in the sciences, we also have to talk about how God sustains the world and the human creature, thereby promoting goodness and love, all right? So, right, God creates us with these capacities to live a flourishing life. God creates us and sustains us with his Spirit to actually experience these. Creation provides the stage, so to speak. God, in his Trinitarian relations with the world, actually provides the means and the ends for this to actually happen, all right? So that's the doctrinal basis. Again, there's others, but I have to leave it there. Now let's talk about some Christian virtues and how we might understand these informing positive psychology. So my colleague and I just released a book. He's a Fuller Professor of Theology and Culture, also teaches in psychology, just finished his PhD in psychology too. In our book, we are basically asking this question: what are some key virtues from Christian theology that overlap with psychology? Sorry about the shameless plug for my book. So, anyway.
It's a great book.
You do these things. You do these things. Thank you. I'll pay you later. We work this out yet. Thank you. So we identify five key Christian virtues that overlap with psychology. In this presentation, I'm only going to talk about these three, only because of time. Okay? So the first one that we're going to mention is justice. So Christian views of justice really talk about action within the world. Walter Brueggemann, really well-known Old Testament theologian and scholar, says this: when the prophets called for justice and righteousness — these are actually two different Hebrew words. Justice and righteousness are normally used together in the Hebrew scriptures, but that's why we have the two, but they're fairly synonymous, but also a little different, but we'll get into that maybe later. They were referring to an order in human society that is viable and sustainable, one in which neighbors can dwell in solidarity with one another. So God's justice is connected with a concrete social reality on earth, okay? And these are items that are missed in the positive psychology conceptions of justice. God's justice is action-oriented, right? So I'm really glad we had this plenary message this morning that even talked about issues of justice, because I believe, as especially as a white male working in psychology, it's my duty to really think about justice in these ways, not only racial reconciliation, but also the ideas of how just injustices occur and working to correct those injustices. Injustices, I believe, if we have a Christian view of it, both in psychology but also for other sciences, it occurs on a systemic level, okay? We have systems in place that are racist, that are unjust. It occurs on a personal level, like John even talked about this morning, that attack that was made on him, right? That would be a personal. But from a psychological perspective, we have to say, with a Christian lens, injustices happen on an intrapsychic level. There is a thing called internalized racism, where people have been traumatized so much by racism that the way that they might view themselves or other people is damaged. You know, it is hurt. But I'm also a clinician, and I see this in my practice all the time. Sometimes the way that we talk to ourselves is not commensurate with the way that God views us, right? Sometimes we can be very cruel to ourselves, right? And sometimes we can be cruel to other people. So in our work in psychology, I believe that we need to work towards eradicating injustices through research and clinical practice. In the book, I talk about really the embodied element of this. We really have to have an incarnational theology. Jesus comes, embodies love, physical, it's real, it's tangible. It's not just something that we intellectualize about. This has to happen on a personal level, this element of justice, okay? If you want to ask me more about it in question time, please do, but we have to move on. So, love. Hey, let's talk about love, everybody. Yes, five minutes. Oh, wow, my clock is right here. In a theological perspective, justice and love go hand in hand. So because God's deep and steadfast love for the world, God is against those things that destroy humanity and human dignity. Love here is a construct that's interesting when we look at it compared to Christian theological version versus the Seligman version. But it's a behavioral and emotional stance, whereas in Christian theology, it conveys this idea of steadfastness, unconditional self-sacrificing. Of course, that's the Greek and Hebrew word for hesed and agape. There's other Greek words if you've read C.S. Lewis's Four Loves. But kind of going on along the lines with what Aaron was talking about, this is something we don't emphasize enough in our churches. But Jesus says, greatest commandment, what is it? Love God and love neighbor, but love neighbor as what? You love yourself, right? Some degree of self-love is presupposed or pre-understood to have a love for neighbor. And again, we're not talking about a selfish, overinflated kind of love. We're not talking about narcissism. But we're talking about some degree of self-care and respect is necessary before we extend love to other people. And this is actually verified in psychological studies, right? We actually have to be able to have a strong enough attachment with someone before we're able to go out and explore and have a relationship with someone else, all right? So relationships that have been neglected or shaped by hatred or violence or greed lead to a diminishment of personhood rather than an enhancement of personhood. And then conversely, relationships that are carefully nurtured over time have the potential to thrive. The last one I'm going to talk about is grace. We can debate whether grace is a virtue. I'm not going to get into that, but I think that this is important given the theological kind of ramifications I want to draw from it. Grace resides in Jesus, of course. When we compare a positive psych understanding of grace, there really is no definition that Seligman and Peterson can draw from. But grace can be understood as God's divine favor. It's a gift of benevolent and loving God. Again, we have an Eastern Orthodox version that I'll talk about later that I think is compelling. Kuyper talks about common grace, God's gracious gifts being extended to all persons, and this creates the ability for both Christians and non-Christians to thrive. This provides the ability, common grace, the idea that even good things can come from a world that doesn't necessarily acknowledge Christ, right? Is this conception of common grace. The closest thing they get to is gratitude. They acknowledge that the Latin root for gratitude comes from grace. And then the other part that I think is very compelling is Vladimir Lasky talks about, in Eastern Orthodox conception, talks about grace being a transforming energy that warms and changes anything that it encounters. And so we argue in our book, and it's a constructive theological proposal, but actually grace is this transforming energy that allows other virtues to thrive from a Christian theological perspective. So it's very necessary. Okay, so let me draw some conclusions here. First of all, I think that Christian virtues deepen and broaden perspectives of human flourishing that are discussed in positive psychology. I think that that's the way we can understand Christianity contributing to this conversation. I also believe that Christian virtues are unique in that they connect us with a reality or a beyond the self dimension that is not always recognized and included in positive psychology. Disclaimer here, Mark McMahon in his book, Science of Virtue, as well as Sarah Schnichter and other, Robert Emmons, a few others, do talk about it in this way, but as a whole, positive psychology doesn't always recognize this beyond the self dimension. I believe this has ramifications for our research because I do believe that qualitative analysis to be able to understand some Christian virtues, these are not only accepted, but they're necessary in order for people to be able to come up with these distinctives and then us to be able to use some mixed method approaches to maybe even do some research on this, okay? And then finally, for Christians working in the field of psychology, one of the things I think that is unique is that if we understand the work of God's Spirit and the idea that God is transforming us, God is pulling us or moving us to be more like him in his image, that these virtues work together to provide a holistic account of flourishing that sustains clinical work and practice. Thank you very much.
Thank you. A few minutes for questions?
Yes.
It kind of ties into your last point, but you mentioned, like, for example, both had kind of two different definitions between settlement and theology.
Mm-hmm.
So have there been studies on that theological definition of both, where it's like, does trusting in God or trusting in the future, does that lead to any different or better?
That's the question, right, that we still have to ask. So I don't know of any that has studied the distinctive nature of hope from a Christian perspective. Aaron, do you know?
Charlotte Van Whitlet is doing more about eschatological hope.
Oh, okay, right now, yeah. But I don't know if she's finished that yet. Yeah. So she's at
Hope
College, right. Yeah. Hope's doing hope, yeah. She might look at some of this. One of the closest things that I know of is Schnitger's work and Kendall Bronk's work at Claremont that does talk about this transcendent element. And Kendall Bronk has actually found that this transcendent element actually is an important conception of purpose. So, yeah.
That's not part of the Solomon.
What's that?
I thought that was kind of part of Solomon's work.
Well, yeah, I mean, the transcendent element isn't necessarily part of the hope understanding for Solomon. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yep.
I think there was another hand.
Okay, other hand?
Jump on top.
Yeah.
Do you have any advice, say, for the Christian colleges to spend more time thinking with, say, freshmen on the formation of virtues in light of what you have discussed today?
Yeah.
Like in a freshman seminar or something that gives vertically to the
Christian. Absolutely, absolutely.
How would you envision?
Yeah, I mean, I love that question. So good. It's forcing me into my teacher mode real quick. So Seligman does have a book called Flourish, and Robert Emmons also his work on gratitude, Everett Worthington his work on forgiveness. I think that all of that research, and there's more out there, those are just the ones that come to mind right now, but each of those researchers gives activities that you can actually do. Right, Robert Emmons' work actually discusses how if you keep a gratitude journal for 2 weeks, it actually reduces depression, right? So I think that the idea of exposing, having people, I've done that in some of my classes, actually have them do some of these activities and talk about how it was for them, right? Yeah, pretty cool, yeah. Over here.
My quick question is, as you mentioned self-love, in your opinion, would you say that self-love requires a degree of self-awareness, that they go hand in hand, or do you think it's possible to promote healthy self-love without self-awareness?
The former, what you said, and this kind of goes a little bit back to what Aaron was talking about, and I'm pulling from attachment theory, so just think real quick about a baby. John Bowlby and his work on attachment, Mary Ainsworth, basically the idea, right, is that the baby holds an idea of the mother as being secure in his mind, her mind, for a securely attached infant. And that secure base gives the infant the ability to explore. Think about an infant who's scared. What do they want to do? They want to stay close to mom. But once a stranger comes in or once somebody, the baby, if mom's around or dad's around, whoever their secure attachment figure is, it could be an auntie or uncle, they begin to explore the world around them. They have space to create for another because they know they're holding some degree of mom in their mind, that mom is there or dad is there. Yeah. So yeah, I do believe that that's important.
I think just to refine that, it was in relation to the greatest commandment, love one another as oneself.
Yep.
That's what I was, do you think, is it possible to love another, to fulfill that commandment without a degree of self-awareness?
I think in the greatest sense, this is just my view, I think that self-awareness has to be there.
Okay.
Yeah,
I do,
yeah. Because basically the reason I'm saying that is because in order to love another and we see this in clinical practice too. In order to love another, we have to have some degree of what's called mentalization,
right,
of being able to put on pause, kind of like what Aaron was talking about, put on pause our own reflection about ourselves, and actually to imagine what it would be like to be that other person, or to imagine or be curious. Right, yeah. Uh-huh.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, sure. Yes, sir.
What's your self-awareness is? Are there any people that actually aren't conscious of themselves?
Yeah, I think that there's a lot of ways to slice it. I don't know if we have time to go into all of it, but I guess what I would just say is that when we talk about maybe a degree of love for self or self-awareness, I do think about it in a psychological sense, but also a theological sense, in the way that we have to have some degree of being a little bit okay with who we are in order for us to be able to be interested and curious about another, you know. Well, it's a great question. I don't know if I have a good answer for that. What I would just say, what's that?
My real question. I have another.
Yeah.
Question. That was just a slight question. I'm a little bit confused. How do you deal with sin or vice or the bad habits or kind of things that could fall this off, sinful nature?
Sure. Yeah, that's a great question. And it's really important for when we talk about flourishing, thriving, because what we believe as Christians, or what I believe, is that God created a world where flourishing happens. And sin is an aberration or a deviation from that, that breaks in and trips it up, right? So that's what I'd say. Yeah. Mm-hmm. All right, I'm probably at time. But, right? No?
Well, we can have one more, maybe.
Okay. Wow, one more. Yes. Huh?
You just mentioned that the concept of grace probably doesn't have a correlation of positive psychology. I'm wondering if compassion / empathy kind of gets at that.
Yeah, I mean, it does touch on the human element of it. Seligman talks about altruism, talks about empathy. There's another one that he talks about under the category of love that do kind of get at some of these things, so you are right in saying that. It just doesn't capture the idea of gift from the beginning, which I think is a really important part of it from the Christian perspective. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And the idea of gift even being given when there's no reciprocity to it. You know, that's the idea of common grace.
Compassion, maybe.
Yeah.
When you altruistically help someone.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Thank you.
Yeah. Fascinating. Thank you again.
Yeah.